Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Red Sox Nation, it's a kind of a family. Wherever I roam, a Fenway home, that's where I long to be. I'm a member of a Red Sox Nation. It's a kind of insanity. Yeah, I live and die with Red Sox pride for eternity. I fake a smile November until opening day. Suffering baseball withdrawal around the clock. When April comes, hey, meet me down on Yawkey Way. That's when Red Sox Nation starts to rock. I'm a member of the Red Sox Nation.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Benny and the Bets podcast covering Boston Red Sox baseball. For everyone staying up late on Periscope, the podcast can be found on SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, Spreaker, Stitcher, Player FM, and wherever you can find it on Google. Red Sox just wrapped up the World Series by winning the World Championship, beating the Los Angeles Dodgers 4-1. And I am Terry Cushman, joined as always by Jeremy Schilling. Jeremy, how are you?
I am wonderful, Terry.
Doesn't get any better than this, does it?
No, I mean, three losses. There was, you know, except for, I guess, game three, some tight ninth innings with Kimbrel. But when you reflect back on the fact that they only lost three games on the way to a World Series, I mean, it was a relatively, by championship standards, stress-free process. So, just, yeah, I couldn't be happier. The only, I guess, downside, if we're going to even bring it up, is the fact that I had tickets to Tuesday night. But, look, it's a World Series championship. I said before, when I found out I had the tickets, I said that I would much rather make sure that we win the World Series than you know, have a risk of going to the game but not winning. So, I mean, it's just so special. It never gets old. And I have a lot to say maybe about the specific events of the game, but reflecting on another championship is getting increasingly difficult. And in the rarest of moments, I'm a little bit speechless.
Yeah, that's exactly what I tweeted. I sat there for literally 3 or 4 minutes trying to craft the perfect tweet, and I couldn't. I just simply said, the Red Sox are world champs. Everybody stepped up, and I'm speechless again. And that's all I could say. And, you know, I mean, we won the series 4-1, and got off to the 2-0 start. My confidence was really high. Then you had that marathon heartbreaker that lasted until 3:30 a.m. Eastern time, and started to get a little nervous, you know, because I didn't think we were going to win game four. You know, we didn't even know who the starter was going to be, and, you know, there's talk maybe it could be Pomeranz, and in hindsight, I'm sure that wasn't really remotely a possibility, but no one really knew going into it. And then it was Erod, and he hadn't really looked great out of the pen, and they were only using him as a lefty specialist. And I'm just thinking, you know, I'm just thinking this could be a tight series that does go 6 or 7 games, but Erod stepped up, and he was left in a little too long, but you know, the bats came alive. We win that game, and my confidence went back through the roof. David Price did his job again. Third win in the postseason after having none coming into it. And
What a series, you know. What a way to end it, you know. What were yours? I mean, I'm sure you felt similar to me after two games. Obviously, I mean, we had to be confident. But what was Game Three like for you? You know, just going through that marathon.
Well, a lot of it was trying to stay awake. I mean, I did everything from fold laundry to literally just stand next to my chair. So I made it as long as I did, which was about the 13th or 14th inning. But I mean, look, there was a range of emotions, starting with the fact that I felt like at the time Cora was spending way too many assets to try to win a game that was not a do or die win. And the amazing thing is he spent all those assets and it didn't matter. Eovaldi to me, and I've been, you know, I, not to toot, you know, pat myself on the back, but to pat myself on the back, credit to me, because I said Pierce is, I had Pierce on the short list for MVP.
You did, actually.
And I actually tried to bet him, but the way I go through the process, it wasn't available, so I took Benintendi. So that sucks, because that would have been like a 2,200 plus bet. So that one still stings. But anyways, I one of the things I was definitely right on was Eovaldi. And I mentioned time in and time out that he was pitching, and he has no contract. He has no financial stability other than the dollars he's already made. He's had two Tommy John surgeries. And I think my quote was something to the effect of, if I was Eovaldi and Corus came to me and said, hey, can you pitch in relief? I'll say, no, I would have said, no, I'll pitch every fifth day. Thank you. He did the exact opposite. And that performance was, in my mind, one of the gutsier, just balls dragging on the ground performances in Boston sports history. And that's saying a lot, considering we just won, you know, what is our 14th championship since 2002. I know you're not a fan of all four teams, but, you know, just generally for the city and the region. I think Price also coming back from the depths of game two of the LDS, another guy who in my mind just dragged his balls on the ground all the way to ensuring that we were clearly the best team. But you know, with regards to that whole 18 innings, I think a lesser team would just so easily use that as a crutch to fold, and they didn't. And, you know, even in the seventh inning of game four, where it just seemed like we weren't going to get any hits, and the offense was just stagnant and there's nothing going on. And by the way, I don't put any stock in Sale yelling like a kid in the dugout. I don't think professional athletes respond to stuff like that, but maybe that's a topic we can get into later or on a different podcast. But it just seemed like they were ready, and it, for whatever reason, it dragged a little bit, but they were coming. And you know, they overcame a defeat that would have crushed so many teams, and then no one would have blamed them, by the way. And then, you know, you hear anecdotes that are actually still coming out today, like, you know, they, you know, well, one, the way they received Eovaldi in the dugout before they went into the clubhouse, and then some of the comments that they literally stand and cheered him in the clubhouse. That stuff just does not happen. And I guess Cora had some comments that they didn't have a players only meeting all year, but they felt the need to address that whole situation. And it, to me, the 18 innings, the next game four tonight, the series in general, the moment was never too big. There was no losing streaks. It was honestly one of the easiest, probably the easiest baseball team to root for that I can remember, because there was really not a ton of adversity. And I guess that game, that 18 inning loss, may have been our greatest adversity, and they so quickly overcame it.
Yeah, you know, and with Eovaldi, it was an extremely inspiring performance, and it seemed like they only took the positives out of it. And you could kind of see when he walked back in the dugout, it was almost like it wasn't a loss. Like, that's not how, you know, that wasn't really the mood. There was nothing but praise at the time, you know, as he came off the field when that game ended. And I just think they took the positives from it, and that's kind of what carried them into game four. And and they just didn't give up. When they were down 4-0, I went to bed, but that's because I was on a self-imposed innings limit, you know, because I had to be up so early today for a 3-hour drive. But it just everybody stepped up. Everybody, I mean, who didn't have a big role in this series? Or this postseason,
Pomerantz,
I should say.
Thankfully.
Well, Pomerantz, true.
But by the way, why he's on the roster, I honestly, and this is, I think, is as good of a theory as any. I think Cora wanted to see if he could win the World Series with a 24-man roster. Because the fact that he was not made available in that marathon in Game 3 just shows you that he's just... Well, I mean, if you're Pomerantz, and one of the things you noticed, Terry, is Fox like almost seemingly avoided showing him. Like, they showed Pedroia every three innings, which, by the way, I could rant on that for about 25 minutes. But they never showed Pomerantz, and I think it just goes to show you that, at least nationally, maybe it was not on purpose, but within that team, there was no faith in that bum.
Actually, with Pomerantz, he was warming in the pen, and I think he would have came in for the 19th inning if...
I know that, but oh, okay. That was, I mean, the 19th inning? Look, here's the crazy thing, right? Evaldi had plans to pitch Game 4 before that whole situation, and they still said, well, we'll figure out Game 4 over, like, putting Pomerantz in this game. You know, and then as you go, okay, now he's at 35 pitches. It's like, okay, well, maybe he can pitch Game 5. Now it's at 50 pitches, and you're like, Game 6. And then he gets to 94 pitches, and you're like, well, geez, I don't think he's going to be pitching in this series again. And by the way, he was warming up in the 8th inning tonight.
He was, yeah. Everybody was. It was like he was playing games. Cora was playing games with Dave Roberts. We'll be like, all right, let's see if Kelly and Barnes makes him nervous. All right, let's add Evaldi in there. And I'm thinking, all right, yeah, that's pretty good. And then before you knew it, Sale's in there. And it's like, holy shit. And
he was really good in that last inning, by the way. He was dominant. They never had a chance of putting a ball in play. So, and I'm glad it worked out that way, because he battled and he obviously was hurt. And we're going to find out that he's going to have his shoulder scoped, or he's going to have something's going to come out maybe as early as tomorrow morning, if not even tonight, where we find out what's finally going on with him, because obviously it's not a belly button situation. But the fact that he came in and was as dominant as he was for one inning, it's an unbelievable feeling. And you know, I know this is not going to be the podcast where we talk about free agency and next year, but you know, Evaldi may have priced himself right out of Boston, but everyone else is coming back, but for Pierce and Kinsler. So it's just one of those situations where it's a World Series, but they didn't do the Marlins version of winning a World Series, which is the emptying the cupboard to do it. There's going to be some changes, but it's not going to be wholesale, and the core is coming back. As far as the Astros having a chance this year to repeat, I think the Red Sox are going to be in a very similar situation next year. So the season's over, and, it's always one of those bittersweet things where there's no baseball tomorrow. But this team is loaded, and we've won a World Series, and it's an exciting time to be a Red Sox fan.
Yeah, and Kimbrel also won't be back. You probably agree on that.
Yeah, no, there's no way. Yeah. I think the only guy that has a chance of coming back is Evaldi, because I think the risk of his health and one of those things too where you could never account for. This team was so goddamn close, and maybe it's something we should have already talked about, but the way they responded to Evaldi, the way they responded to Price, Kelly, the guys coming off the mound, the interactions in the dugout, it seemed different. It seemed like there was a genuine high level of care for the individual. And so it wasn't obviously lost on the players that Price finally overcame his playoff demons and all these other, and I'm not going to get into every single instance of the clubhouse reacting positively to an arm. But, you hope that this team was so close that maybe Eovaldi will take a 2-year, $15 million or $20 million deal to come back, or some discount, because obviously otherwise there are certain guys like that that have just completely outkicked the coverage and they've priced themselves out of Boston. So I hope that feeling that they're going through right now as they're all getting shit-faced in the clubhouse, by the way, what I would do to be in that situation just randomly, I hope maybe it has some carryover to keep a couple guys around.
Yeah, I'm going through my Sox media feed, and it's all celebrations. I did see someone asked Dombrowski about David Price's opt-out, and Dombrowski says, of course we'd like to have him back. We haven't thought about it yet or talked about it. It's ultimately, obviously, Price's call anyway. But that got asked, but there's not really much going on in the line of business. It's mostly still celebrations. Eovaldi, though, I think he's about a 2-year, 24 mil type guy. Lance Lynn got about 12 million, on 1 year coming back from Tommy John. I think that's about where Eovaldi would fall. And I think the Red Sox have a decent shot at bringing Kelly back at a decent price as well. I don't think he's going to get this huge haul, but we'll see.
So let's just talk about that a little bit, because 2 weeks ago we were so down on Kelly, where we were like, well, if he has a role, it's in the fifth inning when the starter can't get deep into the game. And he's now, by the time the World Series rolled around, he was basically back in his role that he was in April. So it's one of those situations where so many different narratives, Price, Sale to a certain extent, Mookie, JD, these guys all contributed. And to the point where Eovaldi, Kelly, Price, there are certain guys who were like, well, and you were basically begging Price. I think I may have mentioned starting a GoFundMe page to get Price out of Boston after game two of the ALDS. And now I might lose sleep tonight over the fact that he may opt out. And if he does, where does that leave this team? So I need Price back. He's obviously embraced the city. In his post-game comments right after, while still on the field, he said, I came here to win a World Series. And, the way he acted and the way he pitched and the way he pitched out of the bullpen and warmed up and put himself in every possible spot the team needed him, it just seemed like a different guy. So he seemingly gets it. And I just go after game two of the ALDS. I said so many negative things. And he well-deserved at the time, so I'm not going to backtrack on him. But he obviously, when he said, my confidence has not wavered, he meant it. And all the way to, he pitched two games on short rests, both wins, both against really good teams, both to end series. It's just unbelievably impressive. And then Kelly, he stunk. He pitched himself basically out of meaningful innings by September. I mean, Terry, we did an episode where we talked about the 25-man roster, and you and I both like seemingly agreed that he would be on it, but like he shouldn't be on the playoff roster. So we knew that they were kind of hoping that he would find something. And I mean, it's like all of a sudden the playoffs start and he's like the Kelly from the Austin, brawl, fearless, dominant. And all of a sudden he's throwing his breaking pitch for a strike for the first time in 5 months, fastballs on the corner, never made misses in the middle of the plate. I don't think he gave up a really a hard hit ball all year. Just truly unbelievable. And I also, it's not lost on me with Kimbrel's contract situation that he was not asked to pitch the ninth tonight. And I tweeted, I think, by the time it was 4-1, so in the fifth inning, I was like, please no Kimbrel. Like, I was begging, like, somehow someone read my tweet to Alex Cora. It's not lost on me that obviously they went a different direction. And I see that he actually was tearing up on the field afterwards, so I think it's all pretty clear that he's gone.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that he's convinced of that, but the thing about the bullpen is, we did agree that Kelly would be on it, but and that he shouldn't be, but this was a terrible bullpen in the month of September. It was just absolutely putrid. And looking back on the month of October now, who was bad out of the bullpen? Name one guy that was bad.
No, I mean,
you can't.
You know, except for game one and two of the ALDS, where Brazier was now uncharacteristically all over the place, and, you know, Erod gave up the bomb to Sanchez and all that stuff. So, but I mean, other than that, since then it was, they were lights out. They were the best bullpen in the playoffs. It actually wound up being one of our strengths, especially where, like, for example, in game four, we were slow to start, and the pitching staff kept us in the game. Obviously, Erod's a big part of that. You know, by the way, tough, just big time balls on that guy to come in where he hadn't made a start in 3 weeks and give you everything he had. I thought the home run had nothing to do with him. I think it had everything to do with Corus, maybe one or two mistakes. That was so clearly a mistake. And honestly, I think you putting him in a position where he felt like he failed in that moment is just it should have never got to that. But yeah, I mean, you know, other than that, all the buttons pushed were right. The bullpen was great. It was a strength. We were better, you know, Jansen and Diaz, absolute studs. You know, Jensen gave up two leads, you know, and Diaz was not, you know, he was okay tonight. Not great. He gave up some runs in game four, or so, or three, I think it was. I can't remember exactly. But anyways, yeah, I mean, you thought that would be the weakness, and it just wasn't.
Yeah, and it started getting to the point where I was like, you know, thank goodness, you know, their bullpen is now in the game, because, like you said, Jansen gave up runs in at least two appearances in the World Series, and Madsen just seemed like he got shelled every time, and a lot of those were inherited runners, but still, his job was to hold them, and he was not doing that. And I just, if we could just get the pitcher out of there. And tonight, I mean, I was watching some of the at-bats versus Kershaw, and none of our lefties were going to look good against him. So we were going to have to try to hold that two-run lead, and maybe someone hits a solo on Kershaw to make it 3-0 or 3-1 or whatever. And that did end up happening, but, you know, not till further into the game. And I'm like, Devers wasn't looking good against Kershaw. Benintendi wasn't really looking very good. I think Vasquez was hitting eighth. He was actually okay. You know, he had some really good at-bats throughout the series. And then Price, you know, batting out of the nine hole, it's just like, and then Mookie was 0 for 13 before finally hitting a solo. So I was like, we're just going to have to weather the storm until the bullpen comes in. And then, you know, maybe we can kind of create a little bit of separation. But luckily, Martinez and Pierce both soloed before Kershaw got out of there. And that gave us a bit of a cushion. And then didn't Pierce hit a second home run as well, I think? Off of a reliever. So I mean, it's just a good thing. And Hill last night was just every bit the nightmare. There was number one, because he's a lefty, obviously, and number two, I guess the Red Sox were one of the worst hitting teams throughout the season against lefties with off-speed pitches. And I didn't, obviously I wasn't shocked by that, but it just kind of confirmed my fears. And, you know, he went, what, 6 1/3, something like that, and was just phenomenal. And that was right before I went to bed. I'm like, geez, I hope he doesn't come out for the seventh. And then they brought him out, and Nunez struck out, and that's when I went to bed. And then the fun literally started immediately right after that. I woke up to, like, a ton of text messages, but yeah, we found ways to win, you know, and in the end, we wanted it more, and that had a lot to do with it.
And to a certain extent, I felt like, you know, maybe the Red Sox were just so talented that teams felt like they weren't going to beat them straight up. In the ALCS, when we went up 2-1 and Hinch, for the first time in 2.5 years, completely revamped his lineup. I remember watching, I think it was the local pregame, and they were reading the lineup with the graphic, and I just said, this is a really weird thing to do. It was 2-1. You're one game, you know, you win tonight and it's even. And I just said, and this team's been so good for 2 years. It just seemed really odd that Hinch felt the need to completely jumble things up. And it seemed like, and I theorized at the time, that he felt like they weren't the better team and that they weren't going to win just going out and doing what they do. And then with the Dodgers, you know, went all righty against Sale and Price in game one and two. And, you know, they have key. I mean, Muncy was the only person who won them a game. I think Peterson had a home run. These are guys they relied on all year. They were their best hitters. Key guys all over the place. I mean, Muncy played second base 2 games in the series, and he's a first baseman. I mean, that's, you know and JD, by the way, wouldn't play first. But so I just felt like they, you know, Roberts felt the same need that A.J. Hinch did after game three, which was, you know, we need to somehow do something out of the box to beat these guys because, you know, again, I think the perception was we can't beat them just going in and doing what we've done all year. And the Red Sox were the exact opposite. They just went in and said, look, we're going to do the same thing. You know, and the fans are getting upset. Like, what is Kinsler doing starting? Well, that's what we do in that situation all year long. And, oh, now Nunez is starting. What the fuck are you doing, Alex? Well, guess what? Nunez has started in those sorts of matchups all year long. We're just going to keep doing what we're doing. And Alex knew, I'm sure, maybe he may not admit this, that they were the best team, and that's all they had to do was be themselves, and they didn't have to get creative and fuck with the lineups and you know. And then for whatever reason, and I'd actually like an answer to this, why the hell Dave Roberts kept bringing out Madsen is absolutely beyond me when he showed a willingness to bring other, you know, Jansen in non-save situations early in the game, you know, 7th, 8th inning. I mean, I don't know, maybe Madsen has pictures, like compromising pictures of Dave Roberts. I have no idea, but it just seemed to me to just never be the right spot. And I sat forward in my seat and I was waiting for the big hit yesterday when I found him back in the game. It's just shocking. So, but the Red, you know, Alex Cora, besides a couple of pitching decisions I didn't agree with, I mean, he just did what he did all year and it was good enough.
Yeah, I think with Madsen, him coming in just speaks to the fact that the Dodgers are a hardcore analytics team that lean on them probably more than any other team in baseball. I mean, I guess the Phillies, I didn't watch many of their games and they, you know, they kind of fell out of it late in the year, but I guess they're going to be that type of a team. But the Dodgers, of all the, you know, contending teams, well, maybe the Brewers, you know, I guess they're on a similar level, but I think they just, with Madsen, they just decided that eventually it's going to average out, and the, you know, the numbers that they have, that their computer spits out, is who Madsen is, and he's going to have to revert to that. Like, that's how it's going to be, and I think they just stubbornly kept going to him when it just wasn't working, and I don't know why it wasn't working. You know, he's typically a very solid late inning guy, but maybe the moment was too big for him. Maybe it was just the Red Sox just, you know, were going to hit him anyway. I have no idea, but I was kind of, you know, especially after last night, I was like, wow, I just can't believe they keep letting this guy burn them. You know, so that's...
Well, you know, the Red Sox are heavy analytics, too. And they were heavy analytics throughout this playoff run. But it, you know, and maybe this was the difference. They eventually realized that the eye test also has to be a factor. And maybe Nunez was hurt, so maybe that's a factor. But Devers did start against lefties finally and had a big hit last night. And tonight, you know, he started. He was in the game. Same with Holt. So they played the analytics. They played the matchups as they are on paper. For Christ's sake, the Red Sox are the team that has employed Bill James for a number of years. So the Red Sox are, you know, a heavy analytics team. One, I'm getting a sense from LA that ownership got involved, or the front office got involved with some of the decisions. And it seems to me that Boston has a division of church and state where Cora has the freedom to do what he wants, and he's not going to have, you know, the Al Davis, you know, phoning down to the sideline to say, hey, we want the deep pass down the sideline. They let him be what he wanted to be, and eventually he got to the point where he understood that despite the analytics, given the circumstances, recent events, the eye test, Devers and Holt were the right thing, and huge factor. And you know, by the way, Holt played awesome tonight defensively. Made a play up the middle I thought was very similar to the one Kinsler wound up throwing away with that Puig, the whole Puig situation in Game 3. So, you know, again, I agree. I do think the Dodgers are heavily relying on analytics, so much so that it seems like maybe they're getting external forces from outside the clubhouse, where the Red Sox, also heavy analytic team, but didn't have those same external forces and were able to make decisions that ultimately had an effect on the series.
Yeah, I mean, the Red Sox aren't near as analytical as the Dodgers, though. I mean, we were just talking about how he wasn't putting Muncy, Bellinger, and all those guys that you would absolutely expect to be in games one and two. You know, sit them one game, I guess, but to do it two in a row and then lose them, I mean, that's absolutely crazy. You wouldn't see Mookie on the bench, you know, for whatever reason. And in the offseason, the Red Sox, the biggest part of analytics that they embraced was actually the defensive positioning and alignments, you know, based on the matchups. You didn't see previously them pulling cards out of their pockets, you know, during the Farrell years with them, you know, with all the information on them as far as where they should be. And that's really what the Red Sox focused on. And I think Cora, you know, with pitching, just kind of, you know, kind of like what you said, the eye test. I don't think he followed any hard rule, you know, throughout the series. And in game three, you know, he went for it. You know, and I don't know that we really expected him to, you know, before the game. I mean, it's impossible to predict 18 innings anyway, but yeah, I don't know. The Dodgers, trust me, are on another level, and I was actually listening to ESPN LA earlier in the week. I forget the two co-hosts, but they were basically talking about how Dave Roberts has to follow a script, and there's meetings before the game with the analytics people, and I think Andrew Friedman as well, who's like the GM or president, whatever he calls himself, and they discuss scenarios before the game. So Roberts isn't taking orders during the game, like he's not calling upstairs. He's got everything before the game, you know, plan A, B, and C with, you know, with the bullpen and, you know, the lineup, whatever, pinch hitting. And he has to follow that. And the Red Sox and Alex Cora don't, you know, he does literally have all the freedom. And there was an article either last year or the year before where Dombrowski was interviewed. I forget, it might have been Evan Drellick or Alex Spear that interviewed him. And Dombrowski said very point blank during the interview, he goes, I don't tell my managers what to do. In fact, I stay as far out of it as possible. I don't have any bearing as far as to what John Farrell does during the game. And that makes perfect sense, because I mean, it was a nightly basis where we're like, oh my god, here comes Tozawa again, you know, why? And you know, and then Dombrowski brings in Ziegler because we desperately needed a late inning guy, especially when Kimbrel missed like 3 weeks because he had his knee scoped, and Farrell wasn't even using him, and Ziegler has a career 1.5 whip, and Farrell was bringing him in with guys on base. You know, that's not what you do with, you know, with guys with a 1.50 whip. You know, they're gonna give up hits and they're gonna walk people. And And so I think that was part of the friction that ultimately kind of did Farrell in. You know, he just wasn't utilizing the guys like Dombrowski had hoped, but like I said, Dombrowski wasn't the type of guy that's gonna. He's never been the type of GM. He's really old school and lets the manager, manage the team and.
You know, yeah, I mean, look, not to get into the Farrell thing because I'm not, but Farrell sucked in game. He sucked. Absolutely. I'm better managing my MLB The Show franchise on PlayStation 4, username ShillKSC20, than Farrell was managing a bullpen and managing assets. Where, for example, Cora on the flip side made every freaking right decision. It's to the point where you're like, no, until you're like, oh my god, yes, like great decision. Not to get down that road, but he sucked. He sucked. And he caught lightning in a bottle in 13, and because he won a World Series in the city, he kept his job for two more years than he should have. But getting back to the analytics thing, and I'm trying to find the name, but I can't. The head nerd of, as the Felger and Maz show puts it, the head nerd, his title is lead statistician or some math, you know, position. And he's been with the team for like 12 years. He's been there, you know, as long as at least Bill James has been involved with the organization. And he said in a quote after game two that he has never felt more a part of the game-to-game operations than he has with Alex Cora as the manager. And I thought that was really telling, because for a couple of reasons. One is, obviously, by the time this World Series ended, Cora had showed he wasn't just going to be a slave to the analytics. But it shows how much he relied on the analytics team portion of the management or coaching or however you want to characterize them. But it showed that he valued the input. And I understand that based on some of the interviews I've heard recently that he actually met with those folks every single day. And a lot of those cards that you see Mookie pulling out of their pocket were from that specific part of the organization. And I thought that it really showed when, for the first time as I can remember in Major League Baseball, they were actually switching outfield spots where they took JD out of left and put him in right for the Machado at bat, I think, in game four. And I think they maybe did it one other time. It just seems, again, like, you know, and maybe it's part analytics and part Cora being so comfortable in his own skin. But he was, and again, the whole Rover thing. He was so confident in his roster or confident in his ability to make the right decision for the ball club that he did things that we haven't really seen. The Rover thing isn't, you know, necessarily maybe the first time we've ever seen that thing. I mean, it's been now given a name, but he utilized it just perfectly. I mean, Eovaldi in game three, you just unbelievable spot there. And he knew it. He knew it. He knew he could ride him out. And, you know, Muncy hits an oppo taco, and you know it tried to for a short period of time flipped the script. But Cora knew what he was doing. I mean, all the way through. And it's part analytics, but at the same time, like you mentioned, Dombrowski never got in the way. And I think we're going to find some things out about this series, and that's why before this podcast, Terry, I suggested we maybe do it again in 3 days, because there's going to be things we find out. We're going to find out about Sale's injury. We're going to find out, you know, the guy that's got to go get a knee scope, whoever that may be, probably Nunez. We're going to find some stuff out about the Dodgers. Like, they've lost back-to-back World Series now. I think we're going to find out that front office, who has gone through the process of putting Magic Johnson ahead of, you know, out in front of their organization, even though he has nothing to do with baseball. Sorry, you know, they're doing things that are not consistent with just letting the team, you know, the on-field product run the operations. I feel like there's definitely some management or front office input that just, in my mind, is not appropriate, and it shows a lack of trust in your roster or your coaching staff.
Yeah, and just so you know, I do plan on doing one probably, Wednesday or Thursday or so. So we'll figure that out, you know, within the next day or two. But with the Dodgers, I'm not going to get too into the analytics now, but I kind of like the human element, and I kind of like, you know, the eye test and just kind of, you know, managing on, you know, intuition, I guess, for lack of a better term. I absolutely hate the idea that some teams are basically going to run everything based on computer printouts. And I love nothing more for these hardcore analytic organizations to lose and fail, you know, to organizations that are still a little old school. You know, like we said, the Red Sox have taken on somewhat of an analytic mindset, you know, with the alignments and whatnot. But it's just...
But they're not a slave to it. That's the point.
Yes,
they're not a slave to it.
Exactly. And the thing that I've always harped on is when you embrace analytics and that becomes the be-all and end-all, what you're saying is, you know, Joe Blow, who can't hit lefties, you know, who is only hitting like 180 against lefties this year, but he's a great hitter against righties. What you're saying is that player will never, ever evolve, you know, into a great all-around hitter with, you know, more normal splits. And I think we saw that with Travis Shaw. That's why Travis Shaw isn't with the Red Sox right now, because Farrell, and I'm not going to go on a tangent about him, but Farrell lost confidence in him in certain situations and basically relegated him to becoming just a platoon guy. And yeah, we needed a reliever, so maybe that helped the trade. But I mean, can you imagine how much better we would be with Travis Shaw? You know, as good as Mitch Moreland's been, but that's Travis Shaw is the perfect example of the analytics mindset failing a player. And you know, so I love what Cora does. You know, he's all inclusive. Maybe we wanted to see Devers a little bit more than what we got, but you know, it worked out. And Nunez had some moments, and Pierce kind of got a little bit more playing time than anticipated because of the hamstring thing with Moreland. But everybody got a shot here, you know, and I like that. And I've been critical on Cora. You know, I still don't like Mookie Betts in the leadoff spot. I'll probably bitch about that. That'll be on my headstone. You know, Mookie should have been a three-hole hitter or something like that. But the one thing I do like about Cora is he's not stubborn with a lot of things. He's willing to make adjustments. And, you know, he does have a high baseball IQ. And when you mention the Rover situation, that's another great example. And I don't... They obviously had that plan coming into the month of October, but I don't think even they knew how brilliant it was going to be until we were at least through the Yankee series. And now it's probably going to be a thing, you know, going forward for future World Series teams. And that's awesome. You know, I'm glad we kind of revolutionized that, you know, and it got us the World Series, basically. And kind of like I said, I don't know if it was the last episode or the one before, but I think having Porcello in the bullpen, having Eovaldi in the bullpen, and even Price and Sale, you know, late in games, I think that just kind of, I just think the other relievers responded to that and stepped up and rose to the occasion. And you know, so I guess you can kind of say I'm a Cora guy now. You know, even though you and I are probably going to bitch about a certain aspect of his lineups next year, you know, on a daily or at least weekly basis, you know, we're going to get...
Well, let's not get it twisted here, Terry. Just because we won this year doesn't mean I don't want to win next year. And he was great, right? He was great. And his issues... that I found actually came, you know, since we've done our last podcast. I mean, we did one after game two. These games went so late, our schedule's a little off, but you know, we were basically just admitting that he's basically been a dominant manager, as if you could even say that, because I think managing in Major League Baseball is the least effective of the four major sports. But he was every decision was right, every move was right. Every time you go that pitcher's being pulled too early or too late, it wound up being right. He screwed E-Rod. He fucked E-Rod.
He did.
Like, that was just not a fair situation. And I know you're going to say, well, Jeremy, he's a pro athlete. What's fair? No, that sucked. I'm sorry. That fucking sucked. That pissed me off in the moment. And the team comes back and wins it, and we didn't do a podcast last night, so we didn't get to talk about it too much. I'm sorry. That sucked. And E-Rod, I can't say enough about that start. He was awesome. Until he couldn't be anymore, and then he was still out there. And you saw him three batters before that situation stand at the top of the dugout, and he's looking at the pitching coach like, what do you think? But it was a lefty. I think it was Jock Peterson. So he loves Jock Peterson, but then he walks him. And it's like, he's done, bro. He's done. Like, stop. Like, it's over. And then you leave him in there to it wasn't Jock Peterson. It might have been Muncy. I can't remember specifically. But then Puig hits a ball that's still traveling. And it's like, why'd you do that? And I think a part of E-Rod throwing the glove, which seemed to be so out of character for him, was he wanted that out so bad. But he knew he was fucked. He knew he had no chance in that at bat. So, I mean, Cora was really, really good. He wasn't perfect. Couple of points I just want to hit on quickly. You know, just as an anecdote, Travis Shaw was traded for Tyler Thornburg. Tyler Thornburg sucks.
He does.
He's terrible. He's a dumpster fire. He will never have a role in this organization. But part of the reason why they were willing to move on from Travis Shaw was Rafi Devers was in the pipeline and they knew it. You know, just a little anecdote there. But then the second thing, there's two things I want to just mention. The Sox, and they talked about it briefly last night. It's one of those things that I've kind of noticed but haven't talked a lot about. The Sox have not followed the launch or strikeout trend. So the analytics say that if you can hit 1 3-run home run per game, striking out 12 to 15 times doesn't matter. And this lineup didn't follow that trend, whether it was the hitting coach who, by the way, every single player hugged that guy, and I think he's not a loud personality guy, so we didn't hear much from him. I happen to follow him on Twitter because I'm a dork, but those guys all hugged him. There were some special moments, and I thought that whether it was Cora or the hitting coach, and his name is immediately escapes me, but I think his first name is Steve. They decided we're not going to be a strikeout or a launch team. We can hit home runs, being aggressive in the strike zone, getting to the proper count, and hitting the ball in the air. We don't need to be striking out all the time. And why I think that's important was because this team had a knack for knocking starters out. And starters, by the way, that were dominating, like Rich Hill in game four is a perfect example, where Rich Hill was really, really good in that game. But that first inning, he threw 21 pitches. By the second, he was at 35. And then you look up, and it's the sixth inning. He's in 94 pitches. And a guy who had been pretty dominant throughout that game, they found a way to get him out. A product of that is not a willingness to, or a rolling over and allowing strikeouts to happen. It's battling. It's fighting. It's shortening up a little bit. And we could still hit there, and maybe this is because they're just so fucking talented, but they could still hit the 3-run home run. They just didn't need to say, hey, we're going to strike out 12 times to get it. So that's one thing where I think they've bucked the trend of the modern Major League Baseball approach to hitting. The second thing is, and I don't know if this is LaVange or the pitching coach or Cora, but they just said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to throw the best fucking guy. I don't care if it's Eovaldi. I don't care if it's Price. I don't care if it's Porcello tonight. I don't care if it's Sale to close the game out. We're not going to throw anyone but who we think is the best guy for that particular inning. So really short bullpen. We didn't see Pomerantz at all, thank God. But we didn't see a lot of guys. Like, we actually didn't see Brazier much for whatever reason in the World Series. They went, our best guys are Kelly, Kimbrel, and then basically the reliever. And then we saw a sprinkling of Barnes and a sprinkling of Brazier. And that was it. It was the best guy. there's no tomorrow. There's no next series. There's no, you know, this is it. And I think you also have to give some credit to the roster for saying we're willing to do this. So, and by the way, I mean, look, at the end of the thing, it's easy to say now, but the signs were there that they were just so clearly the best team in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, they definitely were. Just to kind of touch on some of those things, there's a, you know, you covered a lot of ground just there. With Shaw, he would have been a first baseman, and Hanley would have been the DH, because we're going back a couple of years before JD was really on the radar and whatnot, and before before Moreland. So that's kind of where I kind of had him pegged. But with the Erod thing, I fully agree that Cora left him in to, you know, at least one batter too long, and they even fucked up further by just simply not walking. I'm getting my games mixed up. Never mind. I'm thinking game three. Yeah, we would have
talking about right before the Kinsler era.
Yes, dude, I got crossed up. They should have walked Puig and then you know, pitched to Austin Barnes, who's about as bad as Sandy Leone, you know, for perspective. And it would have been a quick out.
That's a tough comment for Barnes.
Yeah.
Let's not dance on graves, Terry. Come on.
Okay, fair enough. Family. But yeah, so that was kind of an error on Cora's part, and then yeah, with Erod. And the frustrating thing is the guy was so brilliant. I mean, what if I told you, okay, Erod's gonna start this game and he's gonna give up three runs but go six full innings, you're thrilled with that, aren't you? Three runs, six innings from Erod.
Well, I'm thrilled with it, and I would say, what would make you think that's gonna happen?
Exactly. And then he gives up, what was it, just one run or no runs? I don't remember. One run, okay. And then you just milked it. You spoiled the whole start, Cora did. And luckily the lineup saved his ass and won the game. I mean, could you imagine if we're 2-2? I mean, what the hell goes on? They said that Sale would have started game five if that's the case, but what the hell is left of him at this point? And it just would have been an extremely stressful series at that point. And another thing, too, is when we lost game three, that marathon, I couldn't help but think of game three against the Yankees in the 2004 ALDS. We lost that game. We lost that game 19-8 or something like that. And then we go into game four, and that game was a marathon. The Red Sox win that one in like 15 innings. Poppy hits the walk-off. And then the game after that goes 13 or 14 innings. Poppy walks it off again. And we kind of broke their will at that point and then kind of cruised through games six and seven to be the first team to ever win four in a row in the ALCS. And I'm just thinking... with the Eovaldi start, like hopefully they didn't break us with that, and now they're going to go on this disgusting run, you know. And we're seeing our team get managed, like we have said, in ways that no other team's been managed. So how far can you ride that? You know, can you ride that to the end? And we ultimately did, but go back a couple of years with the Indians, where they had a 3-man rotation and they were up 3-1 in the World Series, and then they just got tired and lost three games in a row to the Cubs. So, and the other thing too is, I'm like, we've won three World Series. You know, I'm not going to count 86. I was three.
Four.
We've won four now, right? But we were 3-0 coming into this one, and I kept telling myself, I kept saying, you know, sometime in your lifetime, you're going to lose a World Series. You know, you're not going to win them all. So that's just my own way of not letting my expectations get too high. That way I don't have this epic, you know, rug getting pulled out from under me type moment. And, but it all worked out. It worked out. And I think we said, you know, in the ALCS, the team that wins this match is going to win the World Series. Like, the National League just wasn't scary all year long. And you know, when you get to the World Series and you get in that moment, it's easy to psych yourself out and, you know, start thinking bad things. But in the end, I mean, we were right. You know, we beat the Astros, and we should win the World Series now. And it's just crazy to go through the whole month of October and we lost three games, you know. And granted, there's a lot of off days in there, you know, after every two or three games. But, you know, what a ride, man. I just...
You know, so, which brings me to a, just a broader point, which is 04 versus 18. Because 04 obviously broke the curse. And that team is widely considered one of the best Red Sox teams of all time, if not the best Red Sox of all team of all time. John Henry said on the stage, on the field after the game, that this was the best Red Sox team in history. And it's really hard to disagree with that because it was so easy. Their longest losing streak, I think, was three games, and that was in September when they were, you know, getting things in order for October, or four games, I can't remember. That's a joke. That's a goddamn joke. Four games, like, come on. You know, they started out 17-4 or 6 or whatever it was. It just was so little adversity. And it's always going to be hard slotting a team like that in historically, because 04 overcame a whole bunch of different things that I don't necessarily need to get into right now. But that team was put together to beat the curse. And obviously they did, and they overcame, you know, coming off the Aaron Boone home run, they came back from down three games in the ALCS, and they had Pedro, and they had Kurt, and, you know, obviously they had, you know, Lowe, and that team had to fight. That team had to overcome way more than this team had to overcome, and I understand that they beat the curse, but in my mind, and maybe I'll feel differently the next time we have a chance to talk about this, but, you know, we're now 2 hours after the last out. This team is the best Red Sox team in the history of the Boston Red Sox, because it was so easy, because they dominated from cover to cover, because there was so little adversity. They never had a team meeting. They never had a reason to get together and hash out any issues. Nothing became public. Dombrowski didn't address the bullpen and kept saying the bullpen's fine, the bullpen's fine. They add Pierce, he winds up being the MVP. They add Kinsler, he played a role. It's amazing as we sit here right now, knowing we're the World Series champions, that by championship standards, this was so fucking easy. There was so little adversity. And that's why, even compared to the 04 team, this, to me, is the best Red Sox team. And they're still young. And the core's still young. And there's so many guys coming back.
Yeah, you know, I don't have strong feelings about this. But, I mean, I really like the 07 team. I really think that was a great team. You know, Beckett had the season of his life that year. And Curt Schilling, albeit at 40, was still, you know, a top pitcher, and had a great postseason record anyway throughout his whole career. And I don't know, I just, that was a really good team. And Mike Lowell said that was the best team he's ever played for. And I just, you know, where we say this year was easy, and we only lost three games the whole month, so yeah, I guess it must have been easy, but we had to beat two 100 win teams in the postseason, and on paper that looks great, but it was easy. It was easy. So there were a lot of different factors. Like, a lot of teams had flaws, and I just think the Red Sox addressed theirs the best, and the Yankees couldn't overcome their rotation, and I don't know what the hell Houston's problem was, really. I mean, to get blown out like that, I mean, I don't know if you can tie it to the controversy with the staffer that was recording. Maybe not, but I mean, that was the turning point. You know, after that got addressed, they never won a single game. So
I put no stock in that. I think the biggest factor was Juan Altuve, who had surgery the day after the Red Sox eliminated them, was not Altuve. And that was a major factor. And then two, like I've already mentioned, I thought Hint showed a complete lack of trust in his roster by completely overhauling his lineup after they went down 2-1. Just to put a button on the whole historical thing, because I think it's something we'll talk about more in depth the next time around. That 07 team was really good, and they won 96 games, and they swept the Rockies, and they dominated in the playoffs and everything else. I'm looking at their lineup and some of the things on Wikipedia, and 108 wins and how easy the regular season was. They beat 103-win Yankees team. They beat 100-win Astros team. First team in the history of baseball to beat 200-win teams on the way to the World Series. They've done things that, when you put the numbers in place historically, is a factor. I don't think it can be just glossed over that the regular season was over by September 1st. I think that's a factor in why I'm saying what I'm saying. Because obviously 07, they were a dominant team, and they did – I think they won cover to cover, and they didn't have a ton of adversity, although looking at their opening day roster, there was a lot of differences between their World Series roster. But by the way, Alex Cora was on that team. He just was. As a little anecdote. So, regardless, now we're getting to the position, Terry, that we're arguing who was the best of the of the four World Series teams in the last 15 years. So, champagne problems, which is something I tweeted earlier today when they were arguing on Twitter about who was going to be the MVP. So, you know, champagne problems are good to have. And, look, this team was awesome. And, you know, they not to say they didn't have adversity, because Sale obviously was a shell of himself by the time August 15th rolled around. He was hurt. He was dealing with something again. We're going to find something out, whether it's come out tonight or it's going to come out tomorrow in the coming days. You know, they did, if you recall, I was looking at the 108-win mural on Twitter today because the Red Sox were tweeting certain portions of that wall, which is really cool. And one of the first wins of the year had Hanley. And this team cut Hanley, and I know the circumstances around it were kind of weird, but by the way, nothing came of that whole legal issue. That seems to be a complete non-starter. But they moved on from Hanley, and that could be the sort of thing that could be derisive in a clubhouse, and it wasn't. They completely moved on from it. My understanding is that Hanley was relatively not a problem in the clubhouse, maybe not the best guy in the clubhouse, but you know, you cut a guy like that and you think that could be a problem, and it wasn't. Instead, they go out and get Pierce, and he wins the MVP. So, you know, there were some things along the way, the Sale injury, moving on from Hanley. You know, remember they lost Vasquez for 45 days to the broken finger. So it wasn't completely without adversity, just by relative standards, there wasn't a lot to really worry about.
Yeah, just some stuff going on right now behind the scenes. I wish I could see it because we're not gonna know the context of it. But here's a quote from David Price: "I hold all the cards now. I can't tell you how good that feels to hold that trump card. And you guys have had it for a long time. You've played that card extremely well, but you don't have it anymore. None of you do." And that feels really good. Another quote.
Hold on. Can I comment on that?
Sure.
Hey, David, how about you go fuck yourself, you petty little prick? Next one.
Yeah, this one's a little edgy.
You got to be fucking kidding me with that. Where was that from? Is that something we can rely on? That's not from, you know, Joe Blow journalism. That's from, like, CBS Sports or somewhere?
It's from Christopher Smith from MassLive.com.
Yeah.
Second biggest.
He's reputable. I like him. He's good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me
comment on that a little
bit.
Wait,
here's the second one. Let's just get it all out. From Chris Smith again, by David Price. "I told you guys, Dr. Andrews said, I have a special elbow. I'm sure you guys ridiculed me and mocked me and made fun of me and did everything that you guys do. I wasn't lying when he told me that, and now you guys see that." He just said that.
All right. So obviously some of these phantom injuries are admittedly not real injuries. All right. Well, I take everything positive I've said about David Price. I retract it immediately.
Well, hang on, though. We don't know the context of it. We don't know the tone.
No, the context is. Read the first quote again, Terry, please.
Sure. Let's see.
I follow Chris Smith on Twitter, so I'm going to find him right now and bring it up myself.
Yeah, he says, it's only from 7 minutes ago. He says, I hold all the cards now. I can tell you how good it feels to hold that trump card, and you guys have had it for a long time. You've played that card extremely well, but you don't have it anymore. None of you do, and that feels really good.
All right, I have the quote in front of me as well. All right. So, it's a little ambiguous whether he's talking about the media or the fan base, but it doesn't matter to me. He's basically saying, which I don't know where I could go with this because we just won the World Series and now my blood is boiling. Okay, so Price, you fucking bitch. Okay, the fact that this is what you're talking about when you just won a World Series pisses me off. Just go ahead and opt out and get out of my life. what's your problem, dude? I mean, come on. So now you're going to go back. First of all, don't forget that you went 0-9, okay? You went 0-9. You sucked. You sucked in the biggest moments for your entire fucking career. You sucked in Game 2 of the ALDS. And now, look, I'm going to give you all the credit in the world until I read these tweets, which is you flipped the script, you flipped the narrative, and you pitched balls out. And you pitched in the bullpen, you warmed up, and it wasn't fake. You were going to come in those games. And you pitched on short rest, and you did everything. And now you're going to harken back to, I'm going to rub the noses of the fans and media in it. You know what you were coming into. And now you can't just let it be. And by the way, from what I've seen, a lot of Red Sox Twitter tonight ate a lot of crow, admittedly, including myself. I saw hundreds of tweets of, Kay Smith, who's a Barstool employee now, but 2 years ago was working for NBC Boston. She said, hey, David, and she added Adam. She at David Price, whatever his stupid number is. I'm sorry for calling you an asshole in 2017. Congratulations. So a lot of people, including myself, were eating crow on Twitter tonight, and he's got to come out and be a petty little prick about it. It just pisses me off. So opt out and get the fuck out of my life. It just pisses me. Jesus Christ, you little dink.
Yeah, and
Terry, you got any comment on this?
Yeah, his team carried him into Game 5 against the Astros because he sucked before then.
Right.
They gave him the opportunity to finally break that curse because he didn't do it against the Yankees himself when he could have. At home, where he pitches well against them, or at least he had in a previous start, and then in Game 2 against the Astros, which was his first start of that series, it was a quick start. He went 4 1/3, something like that. Came out with 2 runners on. Almost certainly would have given those runners up had he been left in the game But the Red Sox battled and won that game. And then after that, he finally, pitched to his potential and won 3 games. But this is the guy. And I know I have a tweet that says I can't talk negatively about him, but that doesn't include the podcast. And I hope he does opt out. I'll never get off of that train. I don't care. And he really couldn't have pitched any better those last 3 games. I mean, he was about as dominant as you could hope for him to be. And it ultimately culminated in a World Series. And I am still on the David Price opt out train. And who knows with Chris Sale? I don't know what that does to our rotation. But he's not a guy I want to be paying 30 something million to for the next 4 years. We can find other ways to build our rotation before then, and if we can't do it in the off season, we can do it before July 31st. So I'm not a David Price guy. I keep refreshing my feed here, and literally nobody else is commenting. He's not given quotes to anyone else yet so far. So
good for Christopher Price, because he's good at his job, and MassLive.com is not something well known to people outside of Boston, but they do a pretty good job covering the Boston Red Sox. So, my comments on David Price, because I'm a little bit upset that he's being such a bitch right now about this. And if you read his two comments separately, the second one that you read, but the first one in time, if you're looking at his Price's, Christopher Price's Twitter feed. Smith, sorry.
Yeah.
Christopher Smith, Jesus Christ. He was clearly talking about the media in the first one, but in the second one, in my opinion, he's either talking about the media and the fans or both. Eovaldi's going to play a role. So if he opts out, you just freed up $31 million a year. Eovaldi becomes a Red Sox. There's no question in my mind that he becomes a Red Sox. There's just not a lot else out there right now. And I think David Price opting out would require him to think that Major League Baseball, the other teams, because the Red Sox are not going to re-sign him. They're not going to give him another seven, another. They're just not going to do it. In fact, I think if he did do it, the deal from the Red Sox would be much less than $31 million a year. So I don't think he's going to opt out. But if he does, bye. If we can get Eovaldi, if we can get Price back, I'm not Price, I keep doing that, Sale healthy. It's amazing how much I just switched, by the way, from all the credit in the world to Price to then jumping back on the fact that I think Price is just such a little bitch. The fact that he can't just enjoy tonight, like, go tomorrow. Say it tomorrow. Say it in a week. Say it when free agency starts. Say it when you're on the eve of whether you have to opt out or not. But why are you doing it tonight? It's just like, Jesus Christ. And he doesn't embody the – and we've talked about the text he sent to JD when JD signed. And I know you know that tweet, that text off the top of your head, Terry. But he just he's David Price. He's David Price to a fault. And even in the moments where he said some things on the field, right, that he came here to win a championship, that he knew what he was here to do, that he said after he got shelled in game two of the ALDS, my confidence has not wavered. He said so many right things, and then for it to culminate in a World Series championship and then him to come out and then attack the fans and attack the media as a petty little bitch that he is, it sends me right back into hating David Price.
Well, he's actually here because of the players' union. They weren't going to let him take less money and go to the Cardinals because it sets a bad precedence for all the free agents after him. So he's here because the Red Sox offered an extra year, and that's what the players union wanted, that's what his agent wanted. So
look, we all know that the players union is always going to ask for the athlete to take the most money, the most term. But it doesn't sound like, to me, looking back on that period of time, that he like went kicking and screaming to Boston. I mean, he got the most money from Boston. He went to Boston for the most money. So I don't know if like the union strong-armed him. I doubt it. I think maybe the union said some things, but at the end of the day, the Red Sox offered another year and a lot more money. So
right, but there would have been backlash, is what I'm saying. If he.
That's fine, but Pedroia, by the way, signed, when he was still in arbitration, a five-year deal for $60 million when everyone, in baseball was saying, just wait one more year and you'll get six for $150. So, not all athletes are created equal, and I can't believe I just complimented Pedroia because he's turned into such a little dink too, but I'm honestly, Terry, I was so happy at the start of this podcast, and Maybe this is another champagne problem that we can so quickly I am so quickly maybe moving on to the future, because winning in 2018 doesn't mean that I don't want to win again. And in fact, I expect to win again. This team's really young. The core's together. The Killer Bees are still here. Sale's still here. You know, the catcher position solidified. We're, you know, Bogaerts is in his last year of arbitration, so he'll be back probably at about $15 million. First base is satisfied. Third base is satisfied. I mean, we're good. We're going to be good again. And I want to enjoy this moment, and I was having such a fun time reflecting. And right before you read those tweets, I was talking about 2004 to 2018, and then Price has to become Price again, and he's just a little bitch, and I hate him again just as quickly as I was ready to give him some credit.
The sad part about all this is he's not going to be held accountable because they're about to all ride off into the sunset for the rest of the offseason, and after the parade, that is. And so he's not gonna face the same scrutiny as if he just spouted this off on a Thursday night in July, you know, against the Orioles or whatever.
Red Sox Nation right now is in a state of euphoria, as they should be. You know, only probably a small few have, you know, radio obligations, and those are the professionals. You and I are, you know, out here grinding, and we have a podcast obligation, which is fine, so we're looking at it a little bit differently, but hey, you're right. It's going to go under the radar. Everyone's going to get up tomorrow and be ready to blow David Ortiz, which is fine, but, you know, it's not the way it should be because that's not what he's doing to you, Boston. He's not saying thank you, fans. He's not thank you for the support. Thank you for standing behind me. Thank you for paying my salary and filling Fenway Park and buying the merchandise and buying paying for Nesson and paying for MLB extra innings. No, that's not what he's saying. He's not thanking you, Boston Red Sox fans. He's bitching about you an hour and a half after you won the World Series. He's complaining about you, Boston Red Sox fans. It's ridiculous.
And here's the other thing, because I kind of tweeted, I quoted that the Trump card tweet, and then above it I said, you know, not very humble all of a sudden, ... And this is the other thing I was about to get to, is two-thirds of the fan base is going to rally around this guy anyway because they don't care about integrity or any of that. And so one guy fires back at me and he says, he's speaking to guys just like you. He proved you wrong. Let him have his moment. Another guy says, he earned it. Another guy says, shut the fuck up. He's talking, yeah, basically the same thing. He's talking to everyone who is just like you. And, you know, so that's what it is. Like, we're kind of poisoned by him at this point.
So, look, I don't... Like, all right, well, first of all, you are so much more negative on Twitter than I am. So you're going to get some of that where I just generally don't. Like, I try to be kind of comical on Twitter, and I'm not necessarily optimistic on Twitter, but I'm also not a pessimist. So I'm definitely somewhere in the middle where you clearly lean, you know, on the negative side of being a Boston Red Sox fan, which is fine. And you obviously have 20,000 followers, and I have 120.
We're the same on Price, though. I mean,
we're very similar on Price, but the Red Sox fans. I don't want to piss our listeners off because there's going to be listeners that don't agree with me here. So I want to characterize this appropriately.
I wouldn't even worry about it. I never did.
The people that would just say, hey, give him the benefit of the doubt tonight, are misguided in my opinion, because he's hated you since day one. And look, if you're a Price guy and you jump on Twitter and you're defending Price, he's not seeing it. He doesn't give a shit, right? He cares about the people that hate him. If you can't understand the significance of him taking the moment, that moment, this moment, winning a world championship, and taking that moment and shitting all over you, then you're never gonna see anything but rose petals and rainbows. And I can't do anything for that fan, because Terry, I've said this, I've got no use for the eternal optimist, and I have no use for the eternal pessimist. Right? It can't be all black and it can't be all red. That's not the way life works. That's not the way being a fan of baseball, and that's not the way being a fan of the Boston Red Sox is. So if you're going to sit here and say, hey, let him shit on me, as a Boston Red Sox fan because he just won a World Series, then I got no use for you. You can go fuck yourself too. And David Price, like, it's amazing that, again, you reeled me in. You said some things where I said, okay, he's turned the corner. He gets it. And that's a quote I've said in this podcast the last two or three episodes. He gets it. No, Jeremy, you're an idiot. You're wrong. And David Price, you're a prick. A petty prick. Sorry, hold on. A petty prick.
Yeah. Yep. Well,
it's staggering. It's shocking that he did that. So we'll find out. Maybe he does opt out, Terry. Maybe he did enough with these three starts where he feels like he can get $25 million somewhere else and he'd just rather be outside of Boston. I still don't think so, because as much as he hates, obviously, he hates the media and the Red Sox fan base, he still loves that clubhouse. The clubhouse loves him. So I think he's going to be back. And at the end of the day, I'm probably not going to, once I'm over the fact that he did this in the wake of, on the night of winning a World Series, he said these things. I do think he'll be back, and I do think I think it's in the best interest of the Boston Red Sox that he does come back. And obviously now with the monkey off his shoulders, I think he's free to pitch really well in a whole bunch of situations. Regular season, maybe he now reverses course against the Yankees. And, obviously we get back in the postseason next year, which I think is a pretty good there's a pretty good chance that happens. We don't have to have this narrative starting out where, David, are you going to be good in the playoffs? Well, I was good in the playoffs. I probably should have been the World Series MVP. So, but it's not lost on me that he's just being such a petty bitch about his hatred for the fan base and the media on the night he won a goddamn World Series.
Yeah, true. And he does have, I think, 10 days from tomorrow to decide whether he will opt out, I think is how that works. So, one final thing, I guess, and then we'll wrap it up for a few days. I think it's really important that the Red Sox won a World Series without David Ortiz, because I didn't want that to become a thing, and it would have taken another at least a decade or so before people started saying, you guys aren't anything without Ortiz, you haven't done anything since he retired. So we're kind of, separating ourselves from that era now, and who knows if Mookie will be here in a few years. But, I mean, we're still going to have Benintendi for a while, Devers for a while. We're going to be seeing guys like Chavis, Dahlbeck, probably as early as next year. And, the next era is here, and we've done it without David Ortiz. So I'm glad it worked out.
Okay, so that's an interesting point for a couple of reasons. One, this is something we talked about in the last podcast, so we were ahead of Fox, who mentioned it on the broadcast tonight. The only remaining member of the 13 team is Xander Bogaerts. So they completely flipped this roster over. Pitching staff, bullpen. I mean, everybody, Dombrowski wasn't around back then. It was still Charrington. So total tear down and rebuild. They did it seamlessly. They had some bad years in there, but we've now won three straight AL East divisions. This roster has been built strongly. I do have some concerns about the minor leagues, but that's not for tonight. I think the biggest issue is JD, the signing of JD, and that was kind of like a song and dance. It was like the awkward, prom thing where the guy and the girl want to dance, but they're both being shy about it. So they kind of like wait until right at the time the prom ends. That's what happened in the offseason with JD and the Red Sox. And at the end of the day, JD took a little bit less than he wanted, and the Red Sox paid a little bit more than they wanted to. But, that was obviously a huge factor. We solidified the middle of the lineup with a big-time bat, and he easily could be the AL MVP, but for his teammate, could easily be the runner-up. So we'll find out soon how that goes, but obviously that's a significant factor. But I think it's important for the program, for the team, and Terry, I think it's a really good point that they won with the next iteration, with the next group of guys. And they're all coming back. And you mentioned everybody. You didn't mention JD. He's got four more years left.
Well, if he doesn't opt out after next year.
Well, he's going to – so they're going to have to buy some opt-out. They're going to have to pay him some money to buy off that option because they don't want him to exercise that. Obviously, if it was this year, he would opt out, and he would get $30 million a year. So,
right.
You know, maybe he gets hurt next year. I don't think it's going to get to that point again next podcast, but what I would say is probably by February 1st, you're going to see either maybe a year tacked on and fully guaranteed, or they stay at the 4 years, buy off the options, and add $5 million or $10 million a year, probably $5 million a year, to get out of those, him have an opportunity to leave. So, but look, you're right. And Ortiz had all those big hits. And this year, by the way, there was no one guy. I mean, Pierce obviously was awesome in the World Series, but in every series there was a different guy. And so this team did not rely on the one big bat like those teams back in the day did with Ortiz.
Yeah, and like I said, we'll get into the contract situations and the market values probably later in the week. But all right, well, I'm good with with winning the World Series and putting that in the book. So
yeah, I can't believe that David Price. You know, that's shocking. But yes, getting back to look, Boston Red Sox, World Series champs again. Can't wait to wake up tomorrow. Can't wait to listen to the local radio station. Can't wait to listen to this podcast, which I will do. You know, can't wait to the next podcast. And, you know, for the first time in 5 years, we're going to go into the off season with everyone wanting to be us. And you're going to see a lot of people trying to copy the things the Boston Red Sox did in 2018. And it's an exciting time to be a Red Sox fan. And I, the only thing that's a little bit sad is there's no baseball tomorrow. But when you play this late in the season, guess what? The spring training starts in 4 months. So,
yeah,
you know, it is what it is. You know, Terry, it's been a really fun ride. And I look forward to the off-season activity with you.
Yeah, and seeing how these big free agents end up faring as well. So, all right, man. Well, have a good night, and we'll talk again in a couple of days.
Good night, Terry.
World Series episode in the books. Have a good morning, everyone.
I'm a member of the Red Sox Nation. It's a kind of Sox ride for eternity. I sleepwalk through the days when there's a West Coast swing, married to the TV and the radio. For tickets in October, I'd give anything. Still paying Red Sox debts from long ago.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.